This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Documents often form the backbone of journalists' investigations, but getting them can be difficult. Canada has two processes for citizens to get access to government documents. The provinces and territories all have their own Freedom of Information laws. In Ottawa, it's the Access to Information System, or ATIP. But journalists and others say governments routinely black out or leave out information they're required to release, or they take so long to release it, the point is lost. The Trudeau government said it would enhance the openness of government with Bill C-58, but after being introduced last year, it's still making its way through the Senate. And the Information Commissioner of Canada says complaints about delays and partial information are up 25% from last year.
The clip you just heard is the way many describe the Access to Information System in Canada today, but the clip actually dates back to 2018. Despite repeated studies and promises for reform, the system has long been plagued by long delays, overbroad exclusions, insufficient resources, and an information commissioner without the powers needed to ensure full compliance. The government is currently undertaking yet another reform process as the Treasury Board has released some proposed changes. They've left Carolyn Menard, Canada's Information Commissioner, largely unimpressed. She's relieved that the government is open to change, but warns in her submission that the approaches, quote, lack ambition, and more pointedly, that the review, quote, must not become a justification for further secrecy. Commissioner Menard joins me on the podcast to walk through her concerns with the government's plans and her proposals for improving Canada's access to information law. Commissioner, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. You know, although the frustrations that exist around access to information and reform of the system feel like something that, you know, we're just cycling through again and again. I recall that the last time we spoke, a lot of the conversation was about a system that I think a lot of people were feeling wasn't working well, with delays, backlogs, and the right of access sometimes feeling more theoretical than real. If there's a significant change that we've seen take place, it's at least the prospect of some change through the Treasury Board's review this year. Your submission, I think, has a bit of a mixed note when it comes to that. You're obviously happy to see that the government's open to change, but you offer some real warnings around a lack of ambition and concerns that a review must not become a justification for further secrecy. You know, why don't we get started just with some of those kind of higher level perspectives on this? What about this exercise from Treasury Board and the government has you worried that reform could actually move in the wrong direction?
Well, yeah, thank you, Michael, for having me. And yes, I am encouraged on one hand that the government finally appears to be willing to be amending the Access to Information Act. As you just pointed out, reform is well overdue. Our act is 43 years old. And this review does give us a real opportunity to make real improvements. But I have some concern about the direction of the discussions that was started by TBS. When I look at many of the proposed approaches, I see a lot of focus on managing demand and narrowing the scope of requests. What I don't see enough is a focus on fixing the real problems in the Act that are causing delays and frustrations over the years. I think it's important to keep some perspective as well, because we've been here before. In 2017, the government introduced, as you remember, a bill, Bill C-58, and it did bring some positive changes, and we cannot discount those. But many of the bigger issues like exemptions and exclusions were never touched. And then a year later, we had a one-year review, which was concluded with a 2021 What We Heard report, again, with no amendments to the Act, no legislative proposals. And now we're in the five-year review. And once again, I'm concerned that the focus is not on the real issues and the stuff that has great impact on Canadians' right of access. And it is concerning me. We have an opportunity before us that and we are I'm worried that the momentum will can be lost. From my perspective, there's a lot of issues that deserves more attention. The first is timeliness. At the end of the day, I'm sure we all have said it before, access delayed is access denied. And if we don't deal with those issues, it's going to continue to be. People cannot get the information when it matters, then it loses, the value of what the right of access is all about. We also have to have a really serious conversation about the parts of government activities that are not covered by the Act, like the Prime Minister's office, Minister's office, and even the Governor General's office. We need to address consultation practices between institutions, which leads to lengthy delays. Another one of my pet peeves is I don't have access to cabinet confidence, and this is something we're going to be discussing maybe a little later, but it's definitely an authority that I would wish to be looked at. And stronger oversight over the proactive publication requirements. So for me, the review needs to be about strengthening the system, not narrowing it. And it should be about expanding access, modernizing the framework, reinforcing independent oversight. It needs to lead to real reform. So I just hope that this is not going to be another missed opportunity.
Okay. I certainly, I think there's a lot of people who actively use the system that obviously feel the same way. There's a lot of pent up frustration, I think. You know, why don't we drill down into a whole series of issues? You touched on a few that I want to spend a bit more time on, but there are certainly several, both issues that are in the TBS consultation that you express some concerns about, and then there's some of the issues that aren't really addressed that you want to ensure are on the agenda. Why don't we start with something that I think sounds a little bit administrative, but you single it out and strongly disagree with. Anybody who knows the system or has filed requests knows that a lot of this revolves around records, and Treasury Board wants to change the definition of record to official record, which would seem to limit the Act to records of ongoing business value that's stored in official repositories. Some, they perhaps them, suggest that it's housekeeping, but you're concerned that it's a move in the wrong direction. Can you explain why you really see this as a consequential and potentially problematic change?
It is completely a move in the wrong direction, in my view, and I'll tell you why. One of my concerns is that narrowing the definition of what constitutes a record could put important information beyond the reach of Canadians. And that's significant because more often than not, those are exactly the type of records people are looking for. People want to understand how decisions were made and how programs are administered, how systems operate, and what kind of information were considered for decisions before they were made. At first glance, as you mentioned, this may sound like a technical decision about record management, but I think it's a lot more important than that. It really goes to the heart of the right of access, because once we start narrowing what qualifies as a record, we're also narrowing what Canadians can ask for and what they can ultimately receive. We also have to recognize that the way the government works today has changed completely. Many discussions, recommendations, and decisions happen through emails, instant messenger, collaborative platforms, and other digital tools. Information that may once have appeared in formal memo or briefing note are often captured in these formats instead. We have to be very careful because some of those records could be viewed less official and could fall outside the scope of access rights if we accept the new definition of records proposed by TBS. I'm not going to tell you anything new here, Michael, but there's a important to remember we live in the age where information exists in many forms. Requesters are not only interested in traditional records, but they are also asking GPS data, metadata, and all kinds of types of records. And often these records can provide important insight on how decisions were made and how government system functions. So rather than narrowing the definition of a record, we should be looking at whether certain type of information should be accessible through other mechanism. As I mentioned in one of my systemic investigation with the Immigration and Refugee, Canada, they have portals, and these portals are not used to their maximum. So we can have information that are accessible through the CRA portal, like tax information, RRCC information, like immigration information. Those portal needs to be fixed and led to less access to information being made. All this to say, the focus should be about improving access and finding ways to be more effective by providing the information, not on reducing the type of information that Canadians can access in the first place.
So that's concerns on the record side. Let's turn to delays, which for many is really where the rubber hits the road. You mentioned the concern about access delayed really oftentimes feels like access denied. Treasury Board talks about a theme of fair and equitable access, and they express some concerns that there may be a small number of requesters or perhaps even bots that are overloading the system. Now, I think you've tried to make the case in your response that you're not really aware of evidence that it's bots that are actually filing these requests. And secondly, allowing extensions where one person files multiple requests might hit journalists, academics, those that often file in batches the hardest. What are some of the concerns you've got about potentially penalizing some of the people who use the system most frequently?
So yes, Michael, there is a risk. I don't accept the premise that submitting multiple requests is in itself a problem. Before we change the law, we need clear evidence that there's actually a problem that needs to be fixed. In reality, in most of the important users, like you just mentioned, journalists, academics, researchers, they often request in batches because it's part of a legitimate research project, or they want to understand the government's activities, so they do these multiple requests. It's part of their job. We also need to remember that the Act already contains a mechanism that deal with vexatious, bad faith, and otherwise abusive requests. So, in my view, the focus should be on addressing the real abuse where it exists, not on creating barriers that could discourage genuine users from exercising their right of access.
One of the concerns that often gets raised when you file requests focuses on institutional capacity. And there is discussion about being able to use that as a formal factor in justifying time extensions. You're pretty blunt in rejecting that notion that capacity on from an institutional side might limit access rights. Can you explain a little bit how we're seeing that play out and why you've got concerns about using that as a reason for potential delays?
The solution is accountability, not more flexibility to delay. The right of access is a constitutional right or quasi-constitutional right, and Canadians should not receive slower responses because an institution is understaffed, or because record management is weak, or because internal processes create bottlenecks. It's not the requester's fault. When we see delays, the answer isn't lower expectations, broader exemptions, and longer timelines. The answer is better leadership, stronger management, and a clear focus on results. To me, reform should be about improving performance, not creating new reasons why information cannot be provided on time. And that means being willing to challenge long-standing practices that contributes to delays. We need to simplify processes. We need to reduce unnecessary steps and rethink way of working that no longer serve the public interest. Of course, requesters can help, and they should help. Clearly describing the records that they are looking for and providing clarification when needed can make the process more efficient. But we need to keep this in perspective. The main causes of delay in today's world are systemic. They include lengthy consultations between institutions, information management challenges, and weak compliance mechanisms. All issues that are not being addressed in TBS's submission. Above all, we also need a sense of urgency. Canadians expect public institutions to deliver results in a timely way. We're so used to doing research on Google and getting the answer right away. This is not how it works with the government's access to information system, but definitely we need to have that as a objective. I think we need to rethink also how we measure accountability. Accountability is not just about every process that was being followed, but it's also about outcomes. And did the Canadians receive the information they were entitled to But also, did they receive it when it still mattered? At the end of the day, Canadians will judge institutions on the results that they deliver by and not by the reasons that they are given for failing to deliver those results.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. And from personal experience, you don't want to hear the excuse. You just want to know when it is you're going to get that information for sure. You've mentioned exemptions a few times, and of course, even when there might be cooperation from the requester, the reality is that exemptions often stand in the way of gaining access to certain information. One of the data points that comes out of all of this, which rather stunning to know, that the operations of government exemption in Section 21 invoked more than 10,000 times just last year. You've talked about needing to address some of the changes when it comes to some of the exemptions in Section 21. You're also skeptical of the public interest override that's there. Can you talk a bit about some of the exemptions that are either on the table for reform or the kinds of things you think ought to take place in that regard?
This is when we start talking about we need to change the culture, this culture of secrecy we often hear about. Institutions should start to approach access requests with a commitment to transparency, like really looking at access requests to think about what are we going to give, not what we're going to be protecting. And there should be a presumption of disclosure whenever possible. The purpose of the act is clear. It does say that government information should be available to the public, and any exception should be limited and applied only when necessary. And I don't think in practice that's how it's working right now. A meaningful reform isn't just about changing the wording of the act. It's about whether Canadians will actually receive more information in practice. So while I support protecting, the internal deliberative process in which ministers and public servants have a space to discuss and provide advice, I think the current balance that we have right now is not right. A 20-year protection period is simply too long. In many cases, information could be disclosed much sooner, without causing any harm to the decision-making processes. That's why I've recommended reducing that period from 20 years to 10 years. There are certainly situations where reduction are appropriate and necessary, and this is why we do have the Act. But in many, many cases, the institutions are overly cautious, and it's resulting in heavily redacted records that provide very little information. That kind of approach can undermine public trust, as you know, and make it more difficult for Canadians to understand how the decisions are being made. And I can tell you, when records are excessively redacted, people are often left to fill the blanks themselves. And it leads to misinformation, speculations, and misunderstanding, and complaints to my office. So I can, it causes people to question what information is being withheld and why. So this is one of the important issues because, like you said, Section 21, the operation of government, is the most frequently used exemption in the Act. My investigation have shown that currently that provision would benefit from clearer guidance, and which already exists in other legislation, like in Ontario, so that people know better what kind of information can be provided and what information can be redacted. It would, and I believe public interest should also, we were talking about the public interest provision. It's already a factor when we use discretionary provision, but the public interest should be for all exemptions. Information related to significant risks like public health, public safety, the environment should be disclosed regardless of whether an exemption can be used to redact. Like, this is where the public interest override has meaningful a role to be in the act. And anyway, there's a concrete way to increase transparency and strengthen the public confidence in the access system. And that's why the exemptions and the exclusions should be reviewed thoroughly.
Yeah. No, thanks. No, a lot of that really resonates, I have to say. Both the reading between the lines that often takes place, and you're engaged in some amount of educated guesswork in some instances, but you're never really 100% sure clearly. And that 20-year timeline, I can recall, just a bit of a copyright geek that I am, I was really excited 20 years after Canada had signed on to a copyright treaty, and I was like quite literally saying, okay, once this comes, now I'm going to be able to get the real information in terms of stuff that was otherwise being withheld. And so the 20 years expires, and file my request, and I get back response saying they have no records. It's all been sent to archive or destroyed, because that's just the practice with those long outdated records. But of course, it meant that you would never get access. Either it would be precluded from gaining access due to the 20 years, and then at the end of the 20 years, they're destroying the records anyway, so they're not available. It struck me as just enormously problematic.
Yeah, you would think the retention policy for these type of records would be longer than a 20 years limit, but yeah, there's definitely a problem there.
Yeah, no, there certainly is. Speaking of sort of making available information that sometimes isn't otherwise available for classified purposes or otherwise, declassification's a really, I think, interesting issue that doesn't get a lot of attention. You've been talking about it for many, many years now. And there's a story that comes out that the government ran a pilot, I think back in 2022, where it reviewed more than 17,000 historical national security records. They found that over 90% of them could be released, and that declassification would actually save money. But then nothing happens. The information just remains sitting in storage at the Privy Council office. Can you talk a bit about what that pilot showed, and how this kind of reform around declassification, beneficial certainly from an access perspective, but even maybe one that pays for itself?
Yeah, well, from the first year I was appointed as commissioner, that became kind of my pet peeves, the declassification issue. And let's be honest, we know that the declassification program would create significant efficiencies and save resources. Right now, institutions, I don't know if you know, but they have to review the same historical records over and over again and repeat the same consultations every time there's an access request that is made for those records. We're talking about 50-year-old, historical national security documents. And as you said, the pilot project has reviewed 17,000 pages and concluded 90% of it was no longer necessary to be classified as secret or top secret. So a declassification system would reduce that burden and allow institutions to focus their effort where it needs to be focused. And we know it can be done. We have many countries that have already established a declassification program, including the United States, that successfully balance transparency with the protection of legitimate national security interests. While the models differ, they all tend to have a few things in common: a government-wide approach, clear timelines for reviewing and transferring historical records to archives, and the automatic declassification of records after a set period of time with very, very limited exceptions. In my view, we've already demonstrated that the declassification program would be practical, effective, and achievable in Canada. So I guess the question is no longer can it be done, but why it hasn't been done yet.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of whys in terms of stuff that hasn't seemed to happen. Let me add another why to the pile. The second half of your part two of your submission really focuses on some of the lack of ambition within some of the reform proposals, some of the things that Treasury Board doesn't raise at all. You hinted at it earlier in terms of things that the Act still doesn't cover. Prime Minister's office and a whole range of other services, requesters often being told that the records just aren't under the control of the institution. I know there have been recommendations for expanding the coverage. That's happened repeatedly in the Ethics Committee, I think back in 2023. So here's another why. Why do we keep seeing these kind of the recommendations to expand, and we see it not happening?
I guess I agree with you. It's another missed opportunity. I don't like to repeat myself, Michael, but we must remember why the Act exists in the first place. Canadians want to know how public decisions are made, how public funds are spent, and access legislation must be built around accountability. If an organization is exercising public authority or carrying a functions on behalf of Canadians, there is a very strong argument that transparency obligation should apply to them. So a meaningful monetization of the act should ask whether its coverage reflects the reality of how government operates today and whether Canadians' access rights are keeping pace. So I think definitely we need to look at the coverage of the act, and it's been recommended by everybody. We just need to act on it.
Yeah. You know, the other big element, there's often a focus both on who isn't covered, and then there is a category of records that just, you know, is oftentimes the barrier that you face. And that, of course, is cabinet confidences. And, you know, when you deal directly with ATIP officers, they often come up right away and ask you almost one of the first things is, can we exclude cabinet confidences because of the exclusion in the act? Now, many provinces, Commonwealth peers, Australia, the UK, and New Zealand already allow, at a minimum, the commissioner to take a look. Can you explain what happens behind the scenes with respect to cabinet conferences and why really Canada is trailing behind some of those other countries in terms of, at a minimum, addressing whether or not the exclusion is appropriate?
So this is important because people need to understand when it's an exclusion, I cannot look at them. I cannot see them. And when an entire category of records cannot be examined by an independent oversight body like my office, it completely undermines the public confidence in the system. Canadians need assurance that decisions about withholding information are subject to some kind of independent review. It is important to also emphasize that an independent review is not the same as disclosure. That seems to be what worries the government. Allowing an oversight body to examine records does not mean that those records will be released. Rather, it provides assurance that the exemptions and the exclusions have been applied properly and that the information have been withheld only when the law requires it. Without the independent verification, requesters are left with no way of knowing whether records have been correctly categorized or whether exclusions have been applied too broadly. And the absence of oversight inevitably raises questions about what is being withheld and whether records that are not truly cabinet confidence are being excluded from my review. An independent review serves as an important accountability function. It gives confidence both to the institution that sensitive information will remain protected and to the public that decisions to withhold the information are legitimate and justified. And we know from the experience of other jurisdictions, as you just mentioned, that it's possible to protect confidentiality of cabinet deliberations while still allowing independent oversight. So other jurisdictions have found a way to strike that balance, and I believe Canada should be looking at those models.
Yeah. Now, speaking of oversight, there's also, of course, the issue of enforcement. You know, you've got that oversight role, but enforcement without some real power is in many ways just advice or an attempt to try to get change. But order-making power can make a big difference. You've got that order-making power, but there's really no genuine mechanism to enforce those orders short of going to the federal court, which you've done quite a number of times now since 2019. Can you talk about what you see as the effectiveness or lack of effectiveness of the oversight system, the challenges that you continue to face when dealing directly with government departments to ensure that your findings are followed through?
Yeah, well, the credibility of the access system depends on Canadians having confidence that there is an independent body capable of holding the institutions accountable when access rights are not respected. And that's why I've long maintained that my orders should be enforceable. And yes, they are legally binding, but currently, as you mentioned, if an institution decides to ignore my order, the only thing I can do is go myself to court, spend my resources, and obtain a writ of mandamus to secure compliance. So I am encouraged right now in the proposal, the Treasury Board is recommending making my orders directly enforceable, which means that I could just go to court and ask them to accept that my order is now enforceable. That would provide greater clarity and certainty for everyone involved. There is also a gap when we were talking about independent review. There's a gap when we talk about proactive disclosure obligations, which is covered by part two of the legislation. Currently, there is no mechanism to ensure that institutions are complying with those requirements, and my office cannot investigate complaints related to proactive disclosure. And you would think that you would, if you're talking about transparency commitment, there should be some kind of accountability behind that and a way to review it. Finally, independence is not only about powers, it also about resources. And like other agents of parliaments, I should not have to seek my funding and budget approval from institutions that I may be called upon to investigate. Currently, my budget is approved through a process that involves the Minister of Justice and the Minister of Finance and Treasury Board, which are all subjected to my oversight. Other agents of Parliament, like the Chief Electoral Officer and the Parliamentary Budget Officer, already benefit from a funding model that reflects their independence. So that's something that exists and it's not hard to put in place. So if you want a strong and credible oversight, we need to ensure independence exists not only in the law, but in practice.
No, I think that's a compelling argument to be sure. Why don't we close with this? We've got this process ongoing. There's quite clearly a gap between the kinds of issues that you've identified and are asking for and what Treasury Board's put on the table. The worry I think that some would have is that you take a look at this and, there's this possibility that the government does a few modest things, doesn't really listen to some of the concerns that you've just been raising, and then sort of says, we're done. People express concern. We've fixed it, and this file closes for, another decade or so. Can you talk about if that's what plays out, what will we have missed? And for you, what are really some of the top priorities coming out of this process that you really think need to go through?
Well, I think the entire Act needs to be modernized. Honestly, I like to say to my staff, it's time to act on the Act. So, any reform must result in less in it must in more access and less secrecy. Because if we are doing the opposite, then we're missing the point. Access to information is, as we mentioned earlier, fundamental for transparency, accountability, and public trust. And we see everywhere in the world that the trust in our governments is going down. And if they don't have the information that they're entitled to, the trust is going to be eroded even more. So we deserve, Canadians deserve a system that is faster, more open, and fit with today's realities. So this time we have an opportunity for meaningful reform, and I really do hope that our government will seize this opportunity.
Okay. Let's hope. Well, listen, you've been tireless in pushing for those kinds of changes. As we've been saying, this has been going ongoing for so many years, whether in committees or as different processes. Perhaps this is the time where we finally see some of those changes. And certainly you've put a lot of different possibilities on the board. So thank you both for all the work that you do on behalf of all Canadians in trying to ensure greater access and on this issue. And then, of course, for joining me here on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. And yes, this is an important issue, and I'm happy we discussed it today.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod or follow Michael Geist at MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.